And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin, and at Eagle Strong Voice. Welcome. Our hearts will never sound in slavery, folks. That's why you're tuning in today. You're the kind of person who would rather fight than be enslaved. We fight on many levels. We're here to unite our remnant. And today, our topic is especially relevant, happening at this time in the midst of a Canadian so-called election. We have announcements about the tribunal, the War Crimes Tribunal in Vancouver, scheduled for September 16th. You can follow all of our work, murderbydecree.com, under ITCCS updates. One of the topics today, well, the main topic really, is the source of a lot of these crimes, religious genocide over the centuries. How is it that people can sit in the pews, contribute to these churches, coexist with evil, and consider themselves saintly folks? Historically and morally, this is a big issue. My guest today has been on the show before, Deborah. She's a survivor of crimes against humanity within the Latter-day Saints Church, the Mormon Church in Salt Lake City. She's going to join us. We're going to go into depth on that subject. Before I get to that, though, a couple of very important announcements in terms of the election campaign in Canada for the Republic of Canada. As you know, we've been following our work. We are organizing town hall meetings, rallies across Canada. Three have been confirmed for you folks in Ontario. Owen Sound, September 16th. Picton, Ontario, September 20th. Toronto, September 21st. Mark those dates. We're going to be having rallies, town hall meetings, and other events on those dates. There's going to be other scheduled events. We'll have more on that over the next few weeks. If you want to be part of that, write to Republic of Canada, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofcanada@gmail.com. And related to that, of course, is the War Crimes Tribunal, to which Justin Trudeau, so-called Prime Minister, the Governor General, and others have been summoned. It was decided by the people running the tribunal that we're not going to do yet another inquiry. This is a court designed to shut down and enforce a standing verdict against Crown authorities, the Vatican, and others who have committed these crimes, proven crimes against humanity. So they've decided to take the tribunal on the road. They're not going to hold it only in Vancouver. They're going to be mobile. They're going to be taking it out to the scene of the crime, to these mass grave sites around the West Coast. They're also going to be taking it to the scene of the criminals. They're going to go to the doorstep of the Governor General Trudeau. They're going to follow him around to the all candidates' meetings. And at these town hall meetings and other events that I mentioned, they're going to be presenting the hard evidence, linking the Liberal government with the Chinese death squads that are operating in British Columbia, hunting down and terrorizing Native families to get the liquid natural gas. This hard evidence of ongoing genocide, we're going to be putting it right in their faces. So, in other words, as Sun Tzu said, don't ever do the predictable, especially when you're up against a bigger enemy. Do the unpredictable. Strike when they least suspect it. So that's a little bit of warning to those folks. You know, we do like to warn them, not be totally unfair to these folks. Let them know we are coming. We will be presenting this evidence to all of the people. Now, another thing I wanted to mention just before bringing on Deborah. Yesterday was the anniversary of the massacre of some of my ancestors in France. It was called the St. Bartholomew Day Massacre in 1572, where Catherine Medici and the Pope organized the massacre of as many French Protestants, the Huguenots, as many as they could. Over 20,000 were killed on one night. And right after that, the Pope himself, of course, blessed the event. There was a painting commissioned showing the slaughter of the Huguenots in Paris, where they were cutting people's throats, dumping them in the Seine River. Well, this painting is still hanging in the Vatican. It's a very prominently placed painting in the Vatican Museum. And there's a picture of all that nice, smiley-faced, liberal-minded Pope Francis standing there admiring the painting of the slaughter of the Huguenots, just like he said it was a great act for Junipero Serra, the Franciscan missionary, to kill all those Indians in California in the 1700s. I think they called him, they were inspired by his zeal, I think is the way Bergoglio put it. So it shows you folks that these crimes, religious genocide, the crimes over the centuries, they don't change. And the attitudes behind them don't seem to change either. We're going to get into that today. And without further ado, I'll bring on Deborah. Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Hi. Yeah, I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on again.
Well, you know, it's good to have you back. And it's been a while. I understand the last time you were with us was actually your birthday. So
it was. Yeah, it was.
Well, happy belated birthday, but it's good to have you back. And one thing I wanted to ask you, some of the folks listening might not really know who you are. They might not have heard that show. So I wonder if you could give us a little bit of background about you and the issue you're going to be talking about and some of your own personal history related to that.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I was born into the LDS religion, and part of what my experience, or a big part of my experience, was being very much a part of the cult activities and the ritual killing activities and the sacrifices and the human trafficking and the things that center around what is kind of falls under the umbrella of what's called ritual, satanic ritual abuse. So with that, that is something that I was involved in as I grew up and even married into, and then eventually came out of. And so now that I'm on the other side of that, I see things in a very different way, and I'm passionate about what that experience is and how that affects the globe, you know, just people everywhere. And so my experience is specific to the Mormon religion, and yet that I see and have had experience with it crossing over into other political arenas, the Catholic Church, and even some the colleges, and my experience just is very, it's multifaceted, which tells me that it's not just just my experience. It speaks to the complexity and the far reach that this this particular, you know, ritual abuse has throughout the world, and what its influence is in so many different factions. Yeah.
Well, it's true that I remember when you were talking in the last interview, you talked about the close relationship, you know, between the Catholic Church and Salt Lake City and the Mormon Church, and how children were being passed around in both cathedrals.
Correct.
And you know, it was in the context of Russell Nelson, the so-called prophet or head of the Mormon Church, actually sitting down in Rome last March with Bergoglio, Pope Francis, and opening a Mormon temple. What's your take on that and what that what's going to go on in that temple?
Well, my opinion is really strong about that one, actually. The way Mormon temples, there's always a planning. You know, when you're going to build a structure that is as huge as it is, then they needed to purchase property, which was done, I think it was like in the 90s that the property where it stands now was purchased. It's sitting on acreage, so it's not just the temple itself. It's got four buildings all together on the property, and then it's, I think, not too far from the Vatican itself. I think it's about 9 miles away, so it's a very close proximity as well. And when those temples are dedicated, typically the routine is to, the way the Mormon Church is structured, there's a president, and he has two counselors, or the prophet and the two counselors. The president and prophet are are exchanged. They're, you know, that it's a common term. People interchange that wording often. So it's the head of the church and his two counselors, kind of like how that stands. And then there's 12 other men under that they call the general authorities. And so in all, there's 15. Heads that run the entire church, and then it goes down in a different structure. But the 15 of the 15, then when a church or a temple is what is called dedicated, when they dedicate, go through those ceremonies, they will send anywhere from one to three representatives to that location. And in this case, with the temple in Rome, all 15 left the country to go to that dedication. Now, I actually looked this up, and historically, I had never heard of that.
Right.
And so this was a one-of-a-kind situation, and prior to the dedication of that temple, they, you know, the president/prophet was sitting down in private chambers with the Pope, and, you know, had the photography crew, and they, you know, they broadcast how beautiful that was, and great that was in Salt Lake City. They just said, look at this, we're just crossing borders.
Our information, is that the Ninth Circle is switching their sacrificial rituals out of Catholic churches into Mormon ones. And
yes.
You've already had a personal experience of that, too. Can you talk about any of that?
Oh, that was part of my experience often. So in the temples and in other religious structures that the LDS Church owns, even crossover with me, there was times that I was involved with ritual experiences in Catholic-owned buildings and a cathedral, the Cathedral of the Madeleine, actually, in Salt Lake City as well. So it's the crossover is definitely there, and having the structure built, having the temple that was built in Rome, I've not seen blueprints, so I'm not going from any of that, you know, specific knowledge. I'm going from experience to say that temple, that building is built, and that campus has been built so that there's interchanging tunnels that are connecting the different buildings that go where they want them to go. There's underground chambers where, meetings can be held, rituals will be held.
Could you tell us what those rituals involve?
Sacrifice. Absolutely. You know, I mean, there's human sacrifice, and that can range anywhere from fetus, infant, to children, to grown adults, animals. It's not really limited. It depends on what the conditioning, what the purpose of the ritual is. You know, there's certain things that if they're trying to, you know, do a group conditioning, if they're trying to do some punishment, but it goes through anywhere from killings to documents that are signed, to oaths that are made. And it's done in the lower chambers of the temple. But then also the lower chambers of the temple do branch out into these tunnel systems. And so it's more than just one room that my experience has shown me. There's a number of different rooms, demonstration rooms, there's experimental rooms,
right.
There's all kinds of things like that. So
And some of the people doing this, including the prophet himself, Russell Nelson, that you witnessed aborting a fetus, I believe, and consuming parts of it, which is standard in these rituals.
Right. Yeah, that was part of my experience, seeing children sacrifice, seeing adults sacrifice, having mass sacrifices go on. That's all part of it. It's very graphic. It's very bloody. And it's also very much falling in line with their own meaning. So when I say they, I certainly don't identify with any of it. But there's meaning behind it, and there's energy that goes into it, and there's darkness that accompanies it too. And the irony behind it, and it's a very terrible, terrible, terrible irony, is just a few floors up, there are other ceremonies going on that just people that are members of the church are participating in, that they are very holy. They feel are very holy. They feel are very spiritual, that are bringing them closer to deity, to God, to angels, to miracles in their lives, you know. And so there is this very real polarity going on that above ground or, in places that can be, you know, seen and visited, there are these inspirational ceremonies going on, and yet underneath everything, there is massive bloodshed.
It's a perfect image. It almost is a metaphor for organized religion right now.
Yeah.
And historically and still today. Now,
mm-hmm.
Would the people on the main floor know what's going on in the basement, by and large?
No, not at all. Not at all, unless you're part of it. So you do have to understand that it's not just like there's this hard line that anybody that's above ground is like innocent, has no clue. I mean, management, the people that are in charge of the temples, that are running the temples, the presidents of those, they would be very involved with and very knowing of scheduling. And then there are those that are part of the cult, part of the brotherhood, part of whatever you want to call it, that are attending just because they want to, as part of what they do. It's like walking the walk and talking the talk on the surface, putting on the suit, putting on the dress, having the, you know, the facade. And yet that is part of the facade. I'm going to go to the temple. I am going to attend these meetings. I am going to look like a good member, an upstanding member in the community by just participating in these holy rituals. And, you know, 2 days later or the next month, they're, you know, downstairs killing something. So it's part of, you know, most people, the lay people, people that are really true believers, you know, and feel very close to and resonate with what has been taught, what the doctrine is, what the outlines are. Most would not. They wouldn't know. They had absolutely no idea.
Here's the thing, people don't want to know either, because I remember when I was 15, I was in Greece. We'd stayed on the island of Lesbos with my friend Charlie, and his parents were archaeologists. And down the beach, about 2 miles, a sheep had died. And you could smell that sheep for miles, just one dead sheep carcass. And It's like when people who lived near these Indian residential schools where half the children died, they said, oh, we didn't know what was going on. I find that really hard to believe, because you can smell bodies. Mm-hmm. You can see, You can have a sense of the evil. And that's why I think, let's get into this, because it's how people coexist with the evil right in their basement, right in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about that with you. Let's kind of get into this, because it's this dissociation and numbness that, of course, we all suffer from. To some degree, till we start learning, you try to talk to people about it, and the denial is a way for them to protect themselves. I mean, have you tried talking to Mormons about your experience?
You know, that's a yes. The short answer is yes. The way to go about it is, you know, it's very similar to anybody's attempt to have a difficult conversation, that, you know, you're going to kind of touch in and see what the temperature is, you know, see how somebody may react or may not react. And so there's just, you know, the probing questions that I know what I'm asking for, and I know what I'm looking for, and I also know what answers and how those answers are framed, how they're coming back, because I can go into this conversation with somebody, and they may have a knowledge, or they may have heard about this, or, you know, this kind of thing. And then the reaction to it, you know, as I ask another question, or they volunteer. A lot of times, though, people are great. I mean, we volunteer so much information about ourselves all the time. It's just a constant revelation. If you know what to look for, and you are the kind of person that is engaged in listening to the person in front of you, you will not only hear what they're saying, but you will hear who they are. That's part of the art of listening, definitely. And so when you're looking for something specific, and I'm trying to gauge, is this a person that I can actually really have this nitty-gritty conversation with? Most you can't. But there are a few that can, and there's different levels of that. You know,
no, I mean, what I'm saying is, have you actually told Mormons there's children being sacrificed in the basement of your temple?
A few, yeah, I have told a few that, and they.
Tell me the reaction.
The reaction is dumbfoundedness, and then they then it's like, but I was able to say that. I don't just, you know, that statement can be made only after there's a bit of a trust, you know, conversation that's happened, and then it's like, this is also happening. Believe it or not, this is also part of this. You want to know why this is happening, you know, or whatever. So yeah, and they are dumbfounded.
Somebody's reported that killings are going on. You normally go to the police. You report it. How come these things aren't reported to the police? Now, I know the general answer. Utah is a theocratic state, and the cops and the attorney general and everyone is either a Mormon or they're friends. Okay, so they're all protecting each other. But, I mean, at a more basic level, how do people keep going to church? And this is a question I've been asked ever since I began to uncover about genocide in Indian boarding schools in Canada, right, in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
How do people keep going to these churches, giving money, knowing that it's going to either commit crime against children or cover it up, which is an equal offense under the law to cover it up and conceal it, like Canada does all the time? And it's that question that really led us to the present situation of campaigning to bring down this present regime and displace crown authority, because it's a criminal regime. But it started for me in this basic reality of how can people coexist in these churches with this open and documented crime? Like, what's at a human level, how do you address that?
So I guess my initial reaction to that is really like, well, how do people really know? How do they know? I mean, I know that because I experienced that. However, we won't get into my experience. We're talking about people on the outside. They'll hear that. And even if it lines up and they're like, you know what, I hate to say this, but that actually makes sense. Even if they can get to that sentence and they can say that, it still hasn't, you know, crossed the chasm in their mind of, oh my God, that's really going on. Oh my God, that's actually happening. And what if, can that happen to me? Can that happen to somebody I know? Or is it, or has it, or, you know, they're really doing that. I mean, there's still this disconnect where it's like, yeah, I've heard that, but that's that other, you know, it's so easy to other. In fact, I can relate to this just even in my own experience where I remember the day I was in therapy, and I remember the day, the moment that it finally lined up. Instead of just giving, you know, like speak to it, instead of just giving words to it, that I was a victim, and I use the word victim. I was a victim. I was a victim of this horrendous situation. I was a victim, and I even took it into a rape. I just took it to the simplicity in this scope right here of rape. I was a victim of multiple rapes. I remember actually allowing myself to go there, and all of the tumblers kind of fell into place, and I thought, oh my God, I'm one of those girls. And then I thought, wow, that's an interesting statement. And it made me realize that even I had categorized the women and the girls that had been victims of violence, as far as just even rape or domestic abuse or whatever, as one of them. That was one of those girls. And then somehow I had a category in my head of them, and suddenly I was one of them, quote unquote, and I had to work with myself through that one going, holy cow, I really othered that entire group, and yet that is my
group. Right, okay.
And yet...
This is important because, you know, we all do that. We split off and project on others our shadow, mm-hmm. our worst stuff, right? Because it's really hard to deal with. I remember you told me a story about standing on the sidewalk. When
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
Do you feel like repeating that?
I would. Absolutely. That's it's one of the, it's so typical. We lived close enough to my dad's work that, you know, he would walk to work and walk home. And I remember this was like fourth, fifth, sixth grade-ish. In that age group, and I remember my siblings and I, we would stand out on the sidewalk, and I would look at the clock, and I'm like, oh, it's time for him to come home. He'll be coming home soon. And we would walk out the front door, and we would stand on the sidewalk in this neighborhood, and we would wait for him to see him walking down the sidewalk. And pretty soon, he would come into view, and we would start running towards him, so excited that he was home, and he'd hold his arms out, and he had his briefcase in one hand, and, you know, that kind of thing, and we were like, you know, daddy, and running, and that kind of thing, and he'd pick us up, and it was just this, man, we'd go back as this group, you know, this little happy family thing, and go home, mom had dinner on the table, you know, it was just one of these really iconic situations, and I lived that, and yet, the night before, I was being raped by him, or I had been sold, you know, to other men by him the week prior, or, you know, 3 days from that moment, then there was incest going on, and I was, you know, wondering why I hurt so bad that morning, why I woke up and my body hurt, and there were, you know, little fissures and tears in my labia, in my vaginal area, and I was just like, why does this sting when I take a shower? And I could not line these things up, and yet I'm still greeting him, I'm still excited about seeing him. So I had to repress everything in order to live in that home, in order to live in that state. I had to be in two different mentalities, And so one was very aware of what was going on in the horrible side, and the other side was just like, this is the way my life is. This is my conscious life. And they were completely separate from each other. The repressed part of what I had to do was a constant every day,
right,
every moment,
right,
everything. Yeah.
Now, Deborah, you know, it's horrible. It's horrible when we remember these things. And in no way trying to belittle this, but what it reminded me of when you were talking about that is what every single one of us goes through living in the society. You know, we're brainwashed to have trust in authority figures, even when they're destroying our lives, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
The idea that the Queen of England or the President or anybody could be killing people is just a shock to us, because we've been taught that they have virtue. The higher up you go in the system, but it's the other way around. The higher up you go, the more corrupt and criminal you are from experience. And
right,
it's true in a family, too. So what you've gone through is so important, the process of you recovering and looking at this, because it's something we all have to do to take back our inner power, which has been systematically robbed from us. We're taught to be, excuse my language, but we're raped in the evening, and then in the day, we're supposed to embrace our torturer, right? And,
absolutely,
and pay our taxes and vote and keep putting these powerful people in, even though they're destroying our lives. Right.
Well, it's done by very simplistic things, too. I mean, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about my experience just as a child. And I mean, I was taught, you know, not to swear, no swear words at all. I mean, it was very clean language. Right. And I remember there was, it was a few years later, I think it was in high school. And I remember talking to somebody that had been, my dad was very involved in the community. And so, you know, had one of the things that he did was actually he was part of a baseball team or a softball team. And one of the members of the team was actually talking to me, and we were kind of joking about, you know, swearing. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I just remember this member of the team said, yeah, you should hear your dad's mouth. And I'm like, what? Like, it was so foreign to me that this person could even say such a horrible thing about my dad, that my dad would swear when he was on the field, because I'm like, I'm there, I'm watching, I'm in the stands, of course he's not swearing, you know. But that's not the truth. The truth of the matter is he was actually using foul language. Okay. The discovery process, and then how we allow something as simple as language use, you know, at that level,
right,
is part of it.
Now, on the show, what we try to do is we talk about the problem, then we say, well, what are the ways out of this? What are some alternatives to create? I want to spend the last half of the show kind of talking about that. Because when you were talking earlier, it reminded me of something I learned once, that in Hebrew, the same word for sanctity, it's also used to describe a sacrifice. It's kiddush. It means you make something holy by sacrificing it, right? You have to give
right.
it as an offering. And that's thousands of year old idea implanted in every monotheistic religion coming out of that part of the world. Mm-hmm. And so when you say, how can the people upstairs be thinking saintly thoughts and yet they're killing children downstairs? It's one and the same. Because didn't God sacrifice his only son for all of us? And didn't something good come out of that? Didn't Brigham Young, the founder of the Mormons, see, there's this quote, and I don't have it on me. Maybe you can remember the quote where he's talking about, if you love your neighbor enough, you will sacrifice him, or something like that.
Actually, if you want to give me a minute, I can call that quote up pretty quickly. Hold on just a
minute. It's incredible. And what I'm saying here is that they're not antagonistic. We kill the innocent to sanctify ourselves. That's a basic idea in Western religion, in Islam, Christianity, Judaism, basic idea. And so they're not counterposed. That's why religion has killed more people than any other force on the planet. So,
okay, I found that quote for you if you want me to say that.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was actually published in the local newspaper. So back in 1856, Deseret News, April 16th, Brigham Young was quoted to say, and I start the quote now, will you love your brothers and sisters likewise when they have committed a sin that cannot be atoned for without the shedding of their blood? Will you love that man or woman well enough to shed their blood? That is what Jesus Christ meant, end quote.
You love somebody by shedding their blood to save their soul,
yeah.
Basically. Of course, that's been doctrine in the Catholic Church, going back to Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages, kill the body to save the soul.
So this is the same kind of thing. And that is where it's interesting to me that even the definition of ritual, you know, you and I were speaking a little bit earlier, and I came across this definition of ritual that has been, you know, we talked about, you know, the morning ritual and what people do to, you know, meditate and have their cup of coffee and that kind of thing. And this, it's been really kind of eased into the social areas, you know, just by going, oh, yeah, what is your morning ritual? And when I'm saying, hey, you know what? I am a victim of ritual abuse, and I'm going to put the word satanic at the front of that because of what the elements are on this. However, it's kind of like, well, what exactly is ritual abuse? Well, anyway, I found this definition in a book, and it's just for ritual. Ritual, actions that a person or group does repeatedly following a similar pattern or script in which they've imbued symbolism and meaning. And so here we have symbolism and meaning, and let's save the soul and kill the body. We're going to shed blood. I mean, and this is done repeatedly. It is a ritual. It is not something that somebody's like, well, thank God that's over with and now we're done so we can kind of move on with our lives. When you're part of this ritualistic community, ritual meaning repeating these meaningful things, sometimes, you know, upstairs it's holy and it brings you closer in your, you know, in your belief system to God. But I'm telling you that repeatedly over and over and over, the meanings of what go on behind shedding of blood and
right.
the terribleness of what that is happening. And it's
the language is designed to soften. The language is designed to soften it all. That's pretty obvious.
Right.
You know, even the word abuse, it doesn't mean anything. Even the word genocide now has lost its meaning. The prime minister uses it, right? But like not being nice to people or something. No, it means about raping and killing children and throwing them in a ditch. I mean, how do we, I know how, we've tried and it's worked, but to move to a place where we reclaim and integrate our spirituality into our everyday life, where spirituality is not based on the suffering and mutilation and killing of other people, but rather something that existed before that in nature, what we call the natural law, right? The harmony in existence. And finding that in ourselves and living it, I guess that's the challenge, right?
I think it's a challenge. Yes, absolutely. What it requires, I think, at the very essence, is it requires self-knowing, self-speculation. I mean, the idea of fighting for our true selves, I wonder often, it's like, do we really even know who we are or know
right.
ourselves? Like,
right.
And are we willing to traverse that inner terrain long enough and far enough to really kind of go through those complexities, because there's plenty that we have buried, and there's purpose in that burial of what we don't like and what we don't want to know, because we don't. It's ugly. It's unsavory.
Yep.
It's something that we don't want to own, and yet there's so much I have discovered, at least in my own process, there has become an emancipation and even a higher or a deeper level of self kindness and self-love that comes when I can stand and I can open my arms and I can say, wow, you know, this is me, you know, it's the shadow is here, and there is a compassionate side for me about this, because it helps me understand so much more about what's going on, you know, inside of me, outside of me, the macro, the micro, all of that, and the complexities there. And I'm extremely interested in that inner terrain. That is the most intricate and interesting terrain that I think any of us ever travel. And we do ourselves a disservice to not go there. And so and here's the thing too, is like the government, they who are, you know, the higher they go, the more corrupt they are, they understand that. And so it is so easy to distract us from that inner terrain. That inner discovery, all we have to do is, I mean, we don't want to see it. So then it's so easy. We do it anyway. We're just going to project, and we're going to attack outside of ourselves. Go ahead.
Here's another piece of it. This is termed vicariousness, right? It's like the term the Pope uses, the vicar of Christ. Vicar in Latin means replacement. So So the Pope is saying, mm-hmm. I am the replacement of Christ. I am Jesus Christ on earth. That's what they say all the time. That's what a Catholic believes. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. I mean, to a Christian, that's blasphemy. That's why they killed all my Huguenot ancestors in France, because we're challenging that, right? Mm-hmm. But vicariousness is how the system operates, because what do people do when they vote? They say, well, he'll represent me. I identified with Mr. Trump. He's going to save us, or Mr. Obama, or whoever it is, right? It doesn't even matter what the leader is saying, because they're saying what you need to hear, right, regardless of your politics. They're saying what you need to hear, and you're signing over authority. Energetically, you're handing over their authority. It's like even in a protest, people are saying, please change things for us. Then,
wow.
But another model is, no, we ignore the system. We pull it all back. But it starts, like you say, in yourself, where you identify. You're not handing over to a group your authority, and that's unfortunately what people cannot break from in religions, because it's all designed to do that. Say, you cannot figure things out yourself. You need us.
It's so, thus it begins, right? And the structure of the Mormon Church really reinforces that. It's fascinating that you brought up this vicarious, the word, because the vicariousness is actually, it's a verb. It's a verb in the LDS Church. There are, oh yeah, absolutely. There is in the temples, part of one of the ceremonies that that is actively participated in is what they call baptisms for the dead. So they will go in and they will, the youth actually go in and they will vicariously, and they use the word vicarious, you are acting and standing in place for, there's a lot of history, family history work that's done, and they get, you know, they will gather these names, and so you will have a piece of paper with a person's name on it, and you will walk into the baptismal font, and you are being baptized vicariously for that individual. And so then, since they've already died, the belief is that they're in this waiting area, this I don't know what it's called. Is it purgatory or something?
They call it purgatory in the Church of Rome.
Okay. All right, yeah. So this is, they call it spirit prison, actually, in the Mormon Church. Yeah, so there's this waiting area, this place of nothingness that you wait until Judgment Day. And if you're lucky enough to actually have somebody here on this planet do a baptism for you, and you say, oh, yeah, thank you, I want to say yes to that baptism into the Mormon Church, then it's like you get this little, you know, like extra bonus green card that says, hey, well, not green card,
I know.
You know, you get a green light. Yeah. So vicarious is definitely an active word. It's a verb. It's an action in the church. And so if you're handing over your authority, you actually are participating as a member of this church as that. That's fascinating to me.
No, this is what I'm talking about. I thought of a joke, actually, when you're talking. Somebody said Newark, New Jersey is like purgatory. You're waiting for it to be released. You ever been
I'm
in New
not
York?
Not going to comment.
I mean, I can think of other places like in Canada that are quite like that. But we're talking about how psychologically people are imprisoned. And, you know, when you're a counselor and you're working with somebody who's deeply dissociated, there has to be another voice from outside their neurosis, right? Their mm-hmm. psychosis speaking to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is when you have a whole culture based on a group crime, like in Canada or America or whatever, you have to be exiled from your own culture. And then nobody will listen to you. I found this in 2008 when I was scrubbed from the media, when they brought in the official line on genocide in Canada, and no more could my name be mentioned. You talk to the generation now, they've never heard of me because their minds have been scrubbed of all of this stuff.
Right.
I have to be there from outside the culture, but then nobody knows about you. So you're in this dilemma, just like you find as an ex-Mormon. People have probably been warned about you, and she's crazy, or she's trying to bring down the church, or any of this other crap they say, right? So how do you work around that? What's your thoughts about that?
You know, when I first had a very upfront experience with that in the congregation that I was still a member of, it was fascinating to see myself ostracized and see myself as a pariah. And at that moment, you know, at that time, I wasn't emotionally triggered by that. I had already stepped back and knew all of this stuff. Like I already knew what was going on. And so it was an easier thing for me to actually still attend and be interacting with a congregation, mainly because my children were there. I wanted to actually have more contact and, you know, be with my children as much as possible at that time. And so I would still continue to go to the main meeting, but I was ignored, and, you know, people were warned of me and they didn't know what to do with me. And so I chose to look at it more as a case study. Instead of owning it personally, it was
right.
more of a fascination.
Good.
And so that made it interesting in a way, not that I could actually take that information and then use it in a critical manner and then, you know, have it as something that was going to reinforce, you know, the wound inside of me. It was more like, this is fascinating human behavior, because it wasn't just 3 months prior, I was welcomed by all 450 members, and, you know, that has actually reduced itself down to 4. Fascinating. What is it that got triggered here? You know, and I don't know that I was able to answer that question, but it was like a very small case study for me to watch. And now, as it's getting a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger, the complexities are there, because the attacks or the suspicions that are out there and are actively
yep.
being stirred up are there's a lot to navigate, as I know that you're very familiar with. There are a lot of things that come at you that sometimes you're like, yeah, I've seen that one before, and it's like, whoa, there's a new one, you know. And how to work with that, I think, is, at least for me, in that, to address that question, it's still
yep.
A learning process.
Well, it's brilliant what you're describing, because you're not into their fear tone, right? That energy that they keep everybody in line with.
Mm-hmm.
That is, what might happen to me if I do this, right? That's why
mm-hmm.
when you say to people, come on, let's go have a protest at the church here, you know? Oh, we can't do that. Well, the cops might be there, or some priest might hit me, or, you know, it's like that. And then you cross that boundary and you go, well, wait a minute, if I don't do that, some kid's going to die. I better get down there.
Right.
Right.
Well, and that falls into
energy.
The relatability. Exactly.
Yep.
So
yep.
where are the ethics? Where does your, and then how does your code of ethics get carved up? I mean, do you get to hold the integrity of what your ethics are, or does it get chunked out? And
yep.
those, and the way it gets cut up, you know, like if you want to think of it as your own ethics pie, you know, what parts of this can you access still, or what is it that you're being kept from? And so where are you in your own experience with yourself there? So really what the religions do in this particular thing, the goal is to isolate people. If
right.
they can create this vision of isolation, separation, and you're on your own, man, you can't even make it to God without us, which totally separates
yeah.
you from God,
right?
Right. So,
I just kind of imagine what it would be like to, and plan to do this, definitely, show up in Salt Lake City, set up a kind of table outside the temple, and ask people to sign
mm-hmm.
a petition
mm-hmm.
revoking the tax-exempt status in the Mormon Church. You know,
which is, you know what? Yes. I honestly, that would be that tax-exempt status, and then even doing what I know that you've done before. It's like, don't give money to this church anymore. They are actively killing children. They're selling children. They're doing, you know, like there's human traffic trade going on. And it's known. There's the government actually has done a study. You know, I mean, there was I got to think about this. I was told that the attorney general knows that the highest time of human trafficking that happens in Salt Lake City, there were 3 major events. One was, and one of them is the General Conference. So General Conference happens twice a year in April, you know, first weekend in April and the first week in October. And it's coming up. First weekend of October is coming up. And, you know, for that period of time, for, you know, approximately 3 days or, you know, the week surrounding it, there's a higher percentage of human trafficking that happens. It's highly active in Salt Lake City. So that includes people coming in, and it's not that children are being swooped up and then stuck on an airplane and jetted out, although that is part of it. There's a lot that goes on as far as people disappearing and things like that. However, it's more so a gathering. So they will gather people, gather children, gather whatever into locations, and then people are men, women, participants are flying in and purchasing and buying these children.
Like
and
a farm.
Then once exactly. Doing what they're going to be doing during those days and then flying out. It's still human trafficking. It's still selling and exchanging children's goods, and some of them don't survive it.
It's exactly analogous to these conferences on the family that the Catholic Church has, like Bergoglio went to a big one in Philadelphia. And mm-hmm. at those events, it's like a big livestock festival. They pick mm-hmm. out children, right? And that's
absolutely. Well, and they've got particular places that are designed specifically for that. And this is part of being, you know, involved in that group. You know the secret handshakes. You know the secret signs. You've already paid the money. You know, whatever it is that the exchange rate happens to be, that's currency.
Right.
It's going on and it's happening. Yeah. So, I mean, when people think of human trafficking, I tend to believe that most of the distraction, quote unquote, tends to be, especially even in the state of Utah, it's like, wow, what's going on over in Taiwan? You know, these poor kids in Taiwan, you know, and I'm like, no, actually, it's right on your doorstep. In fact, it could be your neighbor, you know, more than likely the family down the street, you know, you're not going to go, you know, 10 houses away and somebody has got this going on in their life. And that is where you talk, you know, the relatability. It's like you said, how can people do this? It's because they don't know. They can't comprehend that it is surrounding them, that their next door neighbor is experiencing this. Yeah.
And also, even if they know, then they deny and say they can't do anything about it. And even if they're given a means to do something about it, they realize they have to take action. And this is the part where, and I'm telling you, this is the frustration I have every day, because even the people who are so supposedly awake, they will not mm-hmm. act. I'll say, come on, let's organize an action group. Let's stop this stuff. They will not do it. And I don't know why people are so frozen these days, but action seems to be beyond the reach of 99.9% of people, especially the awakened ones. That's my experience.
And see that's frustrating for me to hear, but it's not surprising. I mean, I haven't raised the flag and tried to, you know, bang a drum and gather troops yet, but at the same time, I'm looking at that and I can see why. I can see why somebody would say, "Ooh, that would be suicide." Yeah.
But when we've broken the ice, and when there were systems admitting it, and all the evidence is there, I mean, it's not like mm-hmm. a hell of a big risk, people, right?
No.
More.
And
look at me. I mean, I've been taking out in front, tip of the spear. I'm still alive. I haven't been sued. I'm not in jail, folks. If mm-hmm. I'm not touched, why the hell would you be touched? So it's like simple logic, right?
Well, it's simple logic, but what this, again, I think comes back to, where are you in the relatability? How much time have you actually sat with the thought that this, if it could happen to them, it could happen to me? Or, oh my God, this is going on, and this is I'm outraged.
Let it happen. You know, that, like that quote from Thomas Paine in The American Revolution. He said, "If trouble is to come, let it happen now to me, so that my child mm-hmm. may know peace."
Exactly.
I love that quote because it's like, bring it on. We've got to stop this shit so children in the next generation will have a better world. Like, it's rocket science, right?
It's so important to do the self-engagement that, like I was talking about earlier, it's like that inner training, what you did, I don't know what your process has been, Kevin, on where you've gone and how you've had to learn yourself and actually discover that deeper part of you or the latent part of you through this process you've been through that just is like,
one thing that's come very easily is there's two qualities that seem to be erased from people these days. One is courage and the other is persistence. And I don't know why, but it's absent. And I want to get into this. We only have 4 minutes left on this show, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
And I'm 1 hour limitation, but I want you back again next week. We've also, Katie Stokoe, who's also a regular in our show, she wants to come on and talk about this from kind of a Canadian perspective. So we can do a nice three-way next week. Any final words? I mean, you've got 3 minutes here. I'm sorry to have to, anyway, it's the time clock, it's not me, but 3 minutes. Go for it. Anything you want to say, what you plan to do, anything.
I think, well, I wanted to address really quick the courage and the, what was the other one, the inaction?
Persistence.
Wow.
Courage and persistence.
Courage and persistence. You know, we're in a place, I think, the persistence. You know, what when you look at yourself and you ask yourself, what am I passionate about? And then when you catch on to that, even if it's an I don't know, but this appeals to me. I mean, that is a process of really even what is passion. We are so limited in our scope of even emotion, you know, not even having the languaging for most people don't even know anything beyond happiness and anger. And, you know, like there's like about the big four or something where people are just like, well, I'm depressed and I'm anxious or whatever. But it's like, do you understand the scope of emotion? So even exploring the scope of emotion in there is going to contain the word courage, and you get to find that and discover that. And then being able to be persistent with what it is that you are passionate about. Unfortunately, we have inner blocks and then we have inner and outer distractions, because to be courageous means you're going to have to call up some stuff that you are going to stand for and stand against. And there's going to be an opposition. There's a pushback, whether it's from inside of you or outside of you. And that is going to be, this is where we don't really, I don't know that we've had a lot of experience with having to deal with that. And I wonder if that's why persistence is kind of like, it's easier just to get distracted and go here. Thank you very much. You know, good luck with your thing. And I'll do my life and be quiet.
Yeah. Well, they often say that one moment of experience is worth 100 years of reading or about something. Because we've got to close the distance. And anyway, that's a topic for another show. We've only got a couple of minutes left. I'm really sorry about that, Deborah, but I very much value your words today, your wisdom, your own courage and persistence, having survived this shit, right? Being an example for others. And I want you back next week, so please come.
I would be happy to. Thank you, yes.
Thank you, Deborah. And we will talk to you next week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kevin. It's been delightful. I look forward to it. So
good.
All right.
Here
we go.
Okay. Bye for now. All right. And that was Deborah calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. And for folks who live around there, write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. There is a network forming of ex-Mormons who are taking this stuff on. We've had others on the air about this. Follow our work generally, murderbydecree.com. Go to ITCCS updates. There's lots of knowledge on that site of how you can fight back and win. Over the next couple of weeks, we will be on the road bringing this truth to your community. So here's your chance to go from words to action, people. You're going to save the life of a child and many children tomorrow if you act on what you know. So write to me, thecommonland@gmail.com. And especially those folks in Ontario, to remind you, September 16th in Owen Sound, September 20th in Picton, and September 21st in Toronto, Ontario. Those are our town hall meetings for the Republic of Kanata. And our delegates are not running for election. We are future delegates to a Congress in the Republic of Kanata, which is being formed from the grassroots. You can find more of that at that website, and also by writing to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. We'll send you out all the information. Our final song today is The World Turned Upside Down, beautiful song about our ancestors, radical ancestors in England in 1649, who seized the world directly as we are doing. This is an honor to be with all of you. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Until next week, stay strong, stay clear.